Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, the only organization solely devoted to defending children's rights in the family. And we are going to get to some trending news headlines as it relates to marriage and family. But as always, we are going to kick things off with Bible time. And if you have been listening to the radio program over the last several months, you will know that I am an Old Testament junkie. I can't get enough of the Old Testament prophets, the minor prophets, the major prophets. They thrill me. So I decided to really go back and study Zechariah. I've gone through some of the other more well-known prophets, and I'm like, what about this Zechariah? I've read the book, but I haven't really dove in deep. So at the very, very end of chapter one, it is talking about the four horns that have risen against the people of God and subjected them and scattered them and spread them across the globe away from their homeland. And then it talks about how at the end it says, what are these coming to do? He said, these are the horns which have scattered Judah so that no man lifts up his head. But these craftsmen have come to terrify them, the horns, and throw down the horns of the nations who have lifted up their horns against the land of Judah in order to scatter it. And I'm like, what on earth is going on here? What is this craftsman thing? I feel like I had never heard it before. So I dug in, did a little commentary. And in essence, it is these agents of justice and restoration that God is going to bring to confront the powers that are attacking God's people, their worship, and the fabric of their nation. And it's so interesting because I looked up what Charles Spurgeon had to say about these craftsmen. Like, what craftsmen? Why craftsmen? And Spurgeon says that God finds the right men for this job of tearing down the strongholds attacking God's people. And he says he does not go for four gentlemen with pens to write, not four architects to draw up plans, but four mechanics to do rough work. And it is this idea, and it made me think about how for every season, for every time there is a season, there is a time to make peace and there is a time to make war. There is a time to tear down and there is a time to build. And there is a time to be winsome. And there is a time to be polite. And then there is a time to bring in the craftsmen who are going to wield their tools deftly to destroy the powers that set themselves up against God and his people. And I think we are in such a time as this now that we have for a long time in this country been able to function as peacemakers, and in wherever we can, we still should, where we were able to serve as agents of reconciliation, and wherever we can, we still should, where we were able to be winsome and woo people to the knowledge of God, and wherever we can still, we should. But we are now in a place where there are diabolical forces rending the fabric of society, specifically the family. And it is time for the craftsmen to be called up to service, not necessarily, as Spurgeon goes on to say, when you want to open an oyster, you do not use a razor. There needs less daintiness and more force for some works. And that is where we are. There are some areas right now, especially in the world of marriage and family and child protection, where a delicate hand is absolutely not what is needed. We need a hammer, a precision hammer, not a hammer that's just slashing and burning and striking everything in its path. But the forces that have come against marriage, family, and children have been so effective that we need to return the blow with equal amounts of force, not just for the sake of pure vengeance, but for the sake of justice and restoration. As very often in this first segment, I'm joined with by my executive director, Josh Wood. Josh also is a big fan of the Word of God. Josh, any thoughts on the role of craftsmen in tearing down the horns that set themselves up against God's truth and God's people?
Well, I wonder what Katie from 10 years ago would say right now, or 20 years ago. You know, is it that the world has changed? Is it that the groups opposing us have become maybe more powerful, or that they've been more successful than we thought they would be? You know, what, or is this just the time in, that we're in, and this is just a response to, I don't know. I think that's what I'm wrestling through, is I think there's some validity to some of the ways we've gone about bringing about change in the culture. And I do think the attitude was a little more winsome the last 15 years.
There 100% was more winsome. I think that a lot of that was because we have just gotten to see a lot of the fruit of seeds that have been sown in the soil of our culture over the last several decades that took a while to grow. You know, first of all, grow roots that we didn't necessarily see, then that came up as sprouts that didn't seem to be very threatening. But now they are towering weeds that are choking out the grain. And it is, you know, in my opinion, time to go in and tear them up by the root. So I think that Katie 10 years ago did not have a full grasp on exactly the kinds of harm that were being scattered throughout really every major institution, whether it was academia or media or the school system.
Don't you get the sense, though, that the way they keep people quiet is to say you're a conspiracy theorist or this is the slippery slope? But it does seem like a lot of things that people were being chastised for suggesting 5-6 years ago, or being mocked for suggesting 10 or 15 years ago, are now things that they're trying to convince us are normal and good.
Oh, 100%. And I think that a lot of the conspiracy theorists about a variety of different things have been vindicated. And then we have to be very careful to say, just because it's a conspiracy theory does not mean that it's true. But a lot of the, in fact, I would say, all of the supposed conspiracy theories that were grounded in the world as it actually is, you know, based in human nature, are based on things that are pretty self-evident that you don't necessarily need a PhD to explain away. Those things are reemerging as triumphant, even though they were slandered and mocked as some form of kind of conspiracy theorist.
That's what I was going to say, is it feels like it was, you know, you guys, you're just fear mongering, that'll never happen. And now it's not just that it's happening, it's that you need to actually accept that it's happening and it's good. And I do think this is where, yeah, I think you're right. Maybe our attitude, we need to just recognize that there's a certain level of not, you don't play nice. You don't try to even reason with folks, that the first call of a Christian would be to child defense. Like, well, the first thing we're going to do before we have a conversation is we're going to stop what you're doing. Like, we're going to protect the children. We're going to stop you from, and then maybe we can talk about winning you through our, you know, logic. And if there are people really truly being victimized, which this isn't just the made up a victim, the hypothetical oppression, this is really children losing, you know, their life, being, you know, selected out, being, losing connection to parents. I mean, these are real victimized children. Well, then, yeah, I think that's kind of becomes the, hey, we need to take a different approach because this is happening right now.
Yeah, it's amazing because, you know, at Them Before Us, we argue from the perspective of natural law, that is moral absolutes that you can determine just based on looking at the natural world. And the thing about natural law is you can try to hide it for a while, but it cannot remain submerged. It is like that quote that says you can drive nature out with a pitchfork, but it's always going to return with force. And that is the truth, that like we are rediscovering some of the things that we tried to drive out through propaganda and censorship and under the guise of being hateful or bigoted or whatever. But the truth cannot remain hidden forever. And that leads me to the first article that we are going to cover today. And it is something that appeared in the Free Press, The Good Life According to Gen Z. And it's about this trend among Gen Zers, and that is everyone who's 29 and younger, who is sort of making a pilgrimage back to a more kind of rural, more traditional life, and rejecting kind of the busy, frantic city, upscale caviar eating, $8 latte sipping world that so many millennials chased for so long as sort of the pinnacle of success. And it highlights this new program called Make My Move program that woos these young couples and young families back to small towns that you've never heard of. And a lot of it is taking hold. It talked a little bit about how 3 years ago, about 9% of the applications to this Make My Move program were from Gen Z. but that figure has increased to 20%. So there is something that is appealing about this idea of new couples or new families moving to small rural America. And a lot of them talk about how it feels like this career world where this rat race of making tons of money so that you can pay a rent of $3,500 or a place where you're never going to be able to buy a home, or where, you know, I'm going to work 60, 70 hours a week so that I don't even have money to buy a home and start a family. That just doesn't seem to make sense to me. So interestingly, we have part of Gen Z, a segment of Gen Z that seems to be re-embracing traditionalism.
I love the fact that we've got a group of people who have maybe tasted the fruit of whether it's big cities, high prices, or maybe putting all of our eggs in the career basket and are wanting something different. I think I would venture to say that this, the last 5-10 years have also been citizens, the country maybe as a whole, just beginning to see the fruit of some of these choices that seem great in the beginning. And maybe it's just policies of a certain ilk, but we're starting to see people go, yeah, we've tried that now. Or I'm watching my boss hate their life, put off things like starting a family, it'd be incredibly lonely. And yeah, the cool car just doesn't do it for me anymore. Like, I think there's maybe something bigger or better than all this materialism.
I live in a big city. I live in Seattle. My kids have always lived in Seattle, and there's some perks. I mean, especially when you're talking about the raw natural beauty of Seattle. But it's nice to have public transportation. My 15-year-old who has a visual impairment and is not going to be able to ever drive a car, like, he loves taking public transportation and the freedom that that affords. But interestingly, he and I were just walking around a really small town in Michigan last weekend. And you can walk from end to end, you know, the four blocks of that one little town in about 7 minutes. And if you're kind of moseying, and we were observing all the different shops and how clean it was and how nice it was and how friendly everybody was. And maybe there was only two coffee shops and maybe there was only three or four restaurants, but we went to a couple of them and they were really nice. And so we talked about, you know, the advantages of living in a small town and how it's affordable and you don't, especially with remote work, if you can live anywhere, living in a small town. And we talked about logistically what would that look like? Well, it means that it wouldn't be a 15-minute trip to the airport like it is for us. Maybe it's an hour and a half to the major airport, and maybe it's not, you know, stopping into Costco once a week. Maybe it's a Costco run, you know, an hour and a half away once a month and really stocking up. But even he was like, wow, this is a nice place. I would love to live here someday.
Yeah, that's, I would say that we live in Charlotte. And, but even then, there's the group that lives uptown near the apartments. And I feel the opposite some way. See, I'll go into town, be, you know, able to walk to a coffee shop, or I'm like, wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have a car and we could just go to all these things and the kids and I could just walk out our front door and go to a park? And so you do feel some of that, but then, man, I just can't get over the expenses, just how incredibly expensive apartments are, how expensive the food is. And so when we come back to the suburbs, a little bit outside the city, and cost of living's better, yeah, I can't say that I regret it. And I'm really glad that it feels like the pendulum's swinging a little bit back to the middle on this issue.
I wonder if so much of it is that this is the generation that grew up so marketed to, so consumer driven. Everything was at their fingertips. And I have to wonder if some of it has to do with them opening their eyes and seeing the vacuous nature of that world in a way that maybe the Gen Xers and the boomers didn't, because the world of the internet and, you know, ordering things at your fingertips, or, you know, the shiny city, that had some sort of novelty and appeal to us. But I wonder if when you grow up in it, there is some sweetness to growing up in a small town where everybody knows you, where you're not part of the rat race, where maybe you have less stuff, or you don't have like an updated kitchen with a shiny countertop, but you can live together. You don't have to send your kids to daycare. Everything is affordable. And maybe you can still do work that you love remotely. So I love this trend. I love this shift. Stay with us. We're going to talk a little bit about the rise of cohabitation now among another segment of Gen Z coming up next.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, joined by my executive director, Josh Wood. And we're going to be talking about cohabitation. Now, very interestingly, at Them Before Us, we address all of the major threats to children as it relates to marriage and family, reproductive technologies, changing laws, changing cultural trends. And a lot of the times when you think about the big offenders to children's rights to be known and loved by their mother and father, you think about single mothers by choice or rampant divorce, or you think about two men acquiring a surrogate-born baby in a foreign country and then bringing it back to the United States. And all of those are significant threats against kids. But if you want to talk about one of the greatest threats to kids in terms of raw numbers, it is not necessarily no-fault divorce. It is not necessarily surrogacy. It is not necessarily single motherhood by choice. It is cohabitation. It is the rejection of marriage and instead embracing a life where you are living together and obviously having sex with one another, even though you are not married. Now, that is something that used to be highly stigmatized in our country, but no longer. Now, it is a very common stop on the relationship train, sometimes leading to marriage, and sometimes that's the final station. But cohabitation is not marriage. And we're going to be discussing a paper that was put out by our good friends at the Institute for Family Studies called Cohabitation is Popular, but it's still no replacement for marriage. Josh, do you want to tell us a little bit about what this paper highlights?
Yeah, the headline is that in 1967, fewer than 1% of all people who lived with a partner were unmarried. So if you were living in the same house as somebody as an adult, there was a 99% chance that you were married. Now today, we've grown from just 1%, this is 2023, just 1% being unmarried to now 13%. Now, more adults between 18 and 44 have lived together than have married. This is what this report shows. And it's worth noting, cohabitation does not improve the success rate of eventual marriage. Most people cohabit without clear plans for marriage. I'd say this makes so much sense to me. I think about the challenges that both, obviously you said they're having sex, you're going to have kids, you're trying to raise those kids together. And you're doing all of it without the safety and the promises made, both in front of God and your family, to stick it out come hell or high water. I think the thought of doing that, getting to know someone new, I mean, sure, you've dated for a while, right? But when you live with someone, you're getting exposed to all of their habits, for better or worse. And to do all of that without the safety of that covenant, man, I just don't, that would be incredibly hard. In fact, I've told people all the time, some of the best marriage advice I ever got was on day one, someone came up to me at our wedding and said, the one thing that has saved our marriage, five words, there is no way out. And what he was saying was, you cannot approach any problem that you encounter looking at the door. You have to know, you're safe here, I've committed to you, and we're working through this. And that has been so helpful, because there's dating level commitment, there's living together level commitment, and then there's I've pledged my life future and you're going to be the grandmother of my kids commitment. And I think you have to have that grandmother level commitment to get through some of the stuff that you get exposed to when you do live with someone, when you're around them 24/7 raising their children.
So let's talk about why cohabitation and marriage offer very, very different things, not just to the adults, but to the children. And why it is that I say that cohabitation is probably one of the greatest threats to the most number of kids as it comes to like the raw data. And it is because of this. It is because when you are living together and when you are having sex, what is keeping you together is your warm, fabulous feelings. Now, warm, fabulous feelings, as anybody that has been in a relationship knows, do not last forever. And so when the warm, fabulous feelings go away, very often the relationship goes away. So if you want an enduring relationship, you have to have something that more than warm, fabulous feelings. Now, the problem is in the course of those warm, fabulous feelings that like chemically last about 18 months, And if you're having sex, there's a very good chance you're going to have a baby during that window of the warm, fabulous feelings. But then the warm, fabulous feelings go away. And then what do you do with a baby? Well, what you do is you break up. Very, very typically, cohabiting relationships will break up much more, about three times as often as married relationships. Both of them are going to hit the same kind of bumps and struggles. Both of them are going to realize, gosh, there's some things that I don't really like about living with you. There's some things that now that my eyes are opened after that Twitter-pated 18 months chemical high wears off, you realize, I don't actually like this. There's part of this relationship that I'm just going to have to grit my teeth and get through or adjust to, or I'm going to have to like die to myself so that I can stay together with you. And there are not those kinds of external constraints in a cohabiting relationship. And so very often the relationship ends. If it's just about the adults, maybe that's not a big deal. Maybe it's even something that should happen because you realize, maybe too late, that this is not the right relationship for you. But once there's a baby involved, now what you've got is the child who is not able to live in the same home with both their mother and father married to one another for life and the benefits that that brings. And so we have now, as Josh discussed, more young adults who have cohabited than who have married. Very often, what goes along with that is out of wedlock children, and those children are going to be disadvantaged. So from the perspective of advocating for the rights and well-being of children, cohabitation is a hard no. That's just from the perspective of the kids, but it's even bad for the adults. It turns out that the more sexual partners that you have, very often because you're living with them, if you then want to go on to try to have a successful marriage, even if you don't sleep with your future fiance, your previous hookups are going to impact your ability to bond and connect and commit to whoever it is you find that you do want to spend the rest of your life with. So the truth is that when we are looking at the natural law, when we are looking at what we can know about what we ought to do based on the natural world, we see that shacking up, hooking up, cohabiting are bad for man, woman, and child.
Yeah, well, it's striking to me, stepping out of just the child's rights perspective and putting on my Christian hat for a second. It strikes me that the people with the lowest divorce rates are those who regularly attend worship services, regularly read their Bible, and regularly pray together. And then you go down, the people that are most sexually fulfilled are those who are religious people who are married. And the people who have the longest standing marriages typically have the lowest number of sexual previous partners. So you're going, wait a second. It's almost like God's design meant something. They're having the most success. And again, as Christians, we can't you know, divorce those two things, that the gospel is good. It's good for you. And when we get the data, the data backs up what we know to be true and find in scripture, that God had a plan and it was for our protection.
So Josh, just to validate that point, I retweeted, re-X'd, reposted on X. Gosh, please.
Whatever it is. Yeah.
Again. These stats that I've seen before. But, you know, so often we hear, the rates of divorce are the same in the church as it is for the rest of the world. Well, sure, if you act like the rest of the world, that's probably true. But we have looked at the divorce rates for people based on previous sexual partners. And let's just presume that you are serious about virginity and chastity leading up to your marriage in a church. Do you know what your percentage of divorce is, Josh? Just guess, what percentage is your likelihood of divorce if you don't have any previous sexual partners before you get married?
13%.
Good guess, Josh, but it's 6. Like literally, you can take your divorce rate almost down to nothing if you commit to only having sex with the person you are married to after you get married. It's so interesting to me. Like I was having another X spat. Obviously, I'm on X too much, people. But I was in a little spat because somebody, you know, posted and said, okay, so if you're in a committed sexual relationship with another adult, agree or disagree, you should have sex whenever that person wants you to, unless there's something wrong or it's risky or there's a medical or somebody's sick. But basically, you should want to have sex. You should be open to having sex with the person that you're in a sexual relationship with. And I wrote, and it was like, men, yes. Women, yes. Men, no. Women, no. And I was like, I'm a woman. The answer is yes, but only if you are married. Ladies, you do not owe your boyfriend anything. Not all sexual relationships are created equal. This is just something that, yes, you should be sexually open to having a full reciprocal sexual relationship only with your husband. And then this guy writes underneath me and he goes, yeah, but like, you don't know what kind of sex you're going to have unless you try it out ahead of time. And I was like, LOL, boy, how many men do you know who had a pretty killer sexual relationship with their girlfriend and got married and then the spigot dried up? I personally know dozens, because we have counseled those people. Women's sexual relationship, if she is loose ahead of time, there's no guarantee that she is going to be free and wild after you get married. In fact, it tends to be the opposite. Women who are serious about governing themselves and reserving their bodies for marriage very often then take sexual satisfaction within their marital relationship much more seriously. So just like you said, Josh, this really is about God's good design and following his good design for your flourishing and the benefit of your children.
Well, we are in the middle of a campaign right now. We run it between Mother's Day and Father's Day, and it's called And Not Or. And what we're trying to emphasize through this campaign is that children need both their mother and their father. It's to help build a culture. Again, it's kind of like make my move, right? We're trying to promote something that we want to return to. And we want to push back against this cultural ideology that tells you there's a million ways to do this and that it all turned out the same. And sure, cohabitation before marriage is probably good for you. And it's trying to reinstill some truth here that kids do care that they have their mother and father. Kids don't care about having two Christmases. They want their mom and dad to be together, to stay together. And we use the stat that 50% of children will lose connection with one of their biological parents by the time they turn 18 in this country. That's wild. And we want to push back on that. And one of the best ways to do that is this institution called marriage that does unite the two people to whom a child belongs and helps to protect them, keeps them together, and provides an environment of stability in which they can flourish.
Yep, it's critical. And at Them Before Us, we really are. There are a lot of organizations that know that moms and dads matter. We are the ones that are at the forefront of making that case for the culture, for the courts, in the personal and the political. And we would love your help.
I want to make sure we highlight this incredible gift. We do have a matching gift. We have a very generous donor who said, we want you guys to be sustainable and healthy going forward. This is such a needed message. For every new monthly donor that you add between Mother's Day and Father's Day, they'll match it with a $1,000 gift. So if you're listening right now and you think you've been listening for a while, you think our message is great, you want to support our movement, you can go to thembeforeus.com, make a gift. If you sign up for a monthly gift, they will match it with a $1,000 gift. A gift of monthly gift of any amount will get that match. So yes, go to our website, join us this Mother's Day and Father's Day.
Yeah, please do, because we would love to take advantage of that matching gift. And it matters so much, because this message that kids need their mother, their father, married together with nobody else, is very countercultural, as I'm going to highlight our final story, which is The Atlantic. Okay, The Atlantic, The New Yorker, I mean, like all of these like top tier media, they are constantly running stories about how mothers and fathers married to each other. Talk about a hallmark of the patriarchy. What kids really need is to be raised by a group of friends. I mean, really, it's like any arrangement of adults raising kids together. That's what kids need. That's what's going to make them happy. And that's exactly what The Atlantic ran right before Mother's Day, was this idea that, you know, just because there are some kids raised by unhappy heterosexual couples, therefore, it would be better for kids to be raised by whatever arrangement of adults they can find out there, as long as all the adults are happy. Basically, just recycling all of the terrible ideas that have brought us to the place of rampant divorce, cohabitation, same-sex parenting, transitioning, you know, going from being the mommy to being the daddy, or being a single mother by choice. All of these other things that have hampered and wrecked the lives of children are now just being recycled to promote all different forms of modern families, which statistically are really bad for kids. So, you know, she goes on to quote how the kids are going to be fine whether they have a mom or a dad or two dads or 20 dads. And The answer is no, they're not. As we spend so much time talking about At Them Before Us, we go into detail about it in our first book, Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement. We have fact sheets at thembeforeus.com. We have done entire podcast episodes. We talk about it on the radio with you guys every week. That these different adults in a child's life are not optional widgets. They are non-negotiables when it comes to children's rights and children's thriving. If we are serious about bringing down a lot of the major struggles that children face, mental health challenges, challenges to their physical health, understanding how to form their own healthy relationships, we are not going to be able to, and we must confront, we must be the craftsmen that are going up against the horns saying that actually family can be whatever adults want it to be.
Yeah, I mean, this article is garbage, to be honest, and it just goes into saying how, well, if the primary argument for marriage is that mothers and fathers can pool their income and you got two hands instead of a single mother's hands, then man, wouldn't it be great if you just had a, you know, 20 people all pool their finances together and then they can all raise the kids, as if it just any of the 20 kids or any of the 20 adults are going to be equally invested in an individual child. It's awful, but again, it just shows you there's cultural propaganda at work here and we need to be calling it out.
Yeah, it's not just The Atlantic. It's not just the New York Times. It's the Human Rights Campaign, which is this massive international organization. Honestly, it's the entire Democrat Party. It is the very lucrative wing of the medical industry, Big Fertility. All of them are setting themselves up against who children are and what they need. And it's us, it's you and me, fighting for kids, fighting on their behalf, telling the truth about what they need, and that is their own mother and father, loving them and loving each other every day. Stay with us, we'll be back with your questions in a minute.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, here with my training director, Jen, who joins us for the last third of this program so we can do a little Q&A. Welcome back, Jen.
Hi, Katie. Good to be here. Got some interesting questions I procured from the internet today. Have you ever gone to the am I an, you know, vulgar curse word? Am I a jerk, basically, part of Reddit?
Oh, this is where somebody's wrestling through kind of an interpersonal problem. They're like, am I being a jerk or are they being a jerk? Who's the jerk here? And then it's like you put it out there and people can either be super validating or completely merciless in their judgment of your situation.
Yes. I like searching. I searched through some of those for some marriage and family questions and got a few interesting ones. But we'll start out with it's not as dramatic, but this guy said, my wife and I are wanting to do a bi-monthly or semi-annual relationship checkup. So they're married. Something where we can set aside time to check in about our relationship, make sure everything's going well. What would be good questions for spouses to talk about to do a regular check-in with each other, do you think?
Oh my gosh, this is such a good idea. And part of me is like, oh my gosh, what a great idea. The other part of me is like, when do you have time for this? Who has the time and organization to do this? And maybe it's because our relationship, I feel like, was so frenzied. Maybe that means that we needed it even more because, you know, we went from the time where we were totally exhausted for having little kids. And then we moved into the preteen and teen years where it's like, we would be ships passing in the night. Like he would walk in the door. I'm like, oh good, he's home. And then as I am walking out the door, I'd be like, put the lasagna in the oven in about 30 minutes, make sure that you turn it up. And then when that's done, just make sure that you flip on the broccoli. I'm going to be home in about an hour and a half. And after that, we're going to need to have like 15 minutes together to discuss the finances. And then I've got a meeting I'm going to jump on. I mean, like that was our world, I felt like, where we were just giving instructions to each other as we were passing by. And thankfully, he was very good about having like date nights where we could get together and connect and all of that. But then to have like an every other month or twice a year relationship check-in, I've heard of such check-ins. I admire the people that do this. I was never one of the people that could do it. But if you were to have some questions that you addressed, obviously, you want to be making sure that you have either the same expectations or clearly defined expectations. And then I would say more like as sort of the business mindset of, then you have to be able to measure whether or not you've met those expectations. So like, do we have a level of emotional intimacy, and what does that look like? And is it going to have a combination of like a sexual satisfaction or like the quality time that we've spent together, or feeling like we are the closest to one another compared to anybody else in terms of the kind of information we're sharing with each other? And then I would say you probably need to have some agreed upon goals as it relates to parenting. Like, do we feel like we are on the same page with parenting? Is there a time where you feel like I'm undermining you when you talk to the kids, or vice versa? Do we feel like we're each getting the right amount of time as a family together, but then also individually with each kids? So I would say that what you need to do is establish, what are your expectations? What are your goals? And then, you know, more than just aspirational, wouldn't it be nice if we, you know, felt like we were in love with each other and spending lots of time together? I'm like, psh, hogwash. Measure that business. What are the things that you can say? You know, we've had 4 dates since our last meeting. I always talk to you first about something I'm excited about. I don't go to my friends before I go to you. Like whatever it is, like figure out ways that you can measure whether or not you have met those benchmarks. What do you think, Jen? Like what kind of advice would you give to a husband and wife that want to do some really fantastic maintenance on their relationship and what that would look like?
I saw this really funny meme that said, what nobody tells you about marriage is that you meet your favorite person, but then you get to spend progressively less amount of time with them over time. Kind of joking about, you know, you get more and more kids, or you have job changes and different things. So it does seem like it really requires intentionality. One of the suggestions, even in that thread, talked about the open-ended question of, is there something you need from me that I'm not giving you? I thought you were going to say, when you started to say, whoa, who has time for it? I thought you were going to say, it'd be hard to open yourself up to, I'm giving you space to tell me I'm not doing a good job in one area or another. And I think it requires maybe more on women's case in some ways, that space to say, I'm going to let you say that I'm not giving you something you need. I'm not going to react with defensiveness. I'm going to listen to you. And that both parties kind of need to have maybe some open-ended of, if I could do more of something that would make you feel cared for and loved, what would that be? If I could do less of something, you know, maybe it's working less hours. Hey, I need you to stop working on Saturdays or whatever it is. And you kind of, it seems like you would need to open yourself up to some maybe hard feedback if you want to keep things going and being strong, you know, so in addition to adding in the good things, like you're saying, so.
And if you want to have those kinds of hard conversations, it's much better to schedule them when you're not in the midst of an argument, because I will be the first to admit that I get defensive in those marital conflict situations because I feel like, oh my gosh, I am pouring out. I'm doing everything I can. And now you're unhappy with something that I've done. Oh my gosh, like, what can I do to make you happy? And so it is helpful to say, we're going to have a time that's scheduled where I'm not going to ambush you. And this is something that we do regularly, to just say, what are the things that we agreed upon? And are we meeting those needs for each other? And that's pretty incredible. Like hashtag relationship goals. That's such a good idea.
Probably make sure you combine the harder, more serious conversation with some fun, some physical activity, not just let's stare at each other across the table and talk about what we're doing wrong the whole time.
You know? Also, maybe don't do it when you're in a shared kayak either. Yeah. When you can, I'm so pissed if we're going to just going to dump into the water. Yeah.
Okay, next question. Am I the jerk for wanting to end my 8-year marriage? My wife said she loves me, but she's not in love with me anymore. No cheating, no big fights, just a growing disconnect. We've tried therapy, date nights, and open communication. On paper, our life is great, but the spark is gone. And I think we both feel it. Should I end the marriage and go find that deeper connection elsewhere? I think this is a man. Yeah, it's a man writing.
Yeah, well, I'm like, well, you can end the marriage. You'll find a deeper spark somewhere for about 18 months, because that's how long the spark lasts. I mean, that is what C.S. Lewis talks about. That spark is like the engine that starts the car. Like, it's that initial bang. It's that combustion. Very exciting, very euphoric. But after a while, that spark has to give way to the slower burn of the engine that sustains you and allows you to drive for long distances. And so I understand that the spark is gone. I think anybody that's been married for longer than 18 months understands that kind of feelings come and feelings go. They rise and they fall. And interestingly, you don't have to just passively let them come or let them go. You can actually do things to get the spark back. But also, I would say the spark is not the most important thing. I think it's really sweet when you do have those times where you feel really in love. And we, you know, we've had times where, like a roller coaster, you get to the top and you're like, oh my gosh, I feel so in love with you. And then you slide down and get to the bottom and you're just in a grind for a month or a year or 3 years. And then something happens and you get back up to the top. And a lot of times the something that happens is not just, whoops, oh, we tripped onto having another spark. It is because you are generally working shoulder to shoulder together towards a mutual goal or overcoming a mutual obstacle, not with the obstacle in between you where it's a face-off, but where you're tackling the obstacle together as allies. Another really key trick that I have found that my husband and I have deciphered as a way to make sure that even if it's not a spark, as in like the puppy dog love, where at least it's a durable, genuinely emotional connection, is you will feel emotionally close to with whom you are sharing emotional information. So if you want to create emotional intimacy, you share emotional information. The things you feel the most protective of, the things you feel the most excited about, the things you're the most afraid of, the things that you're the most hopeful for. If you share those, whoever you share them with, especially if you receive a rewarding response, whether that is the right kind of sympathy or the right kind of elation, you will form an emotional bond with them. So there was times where I would share that first initial emotional information or excitement or triumph with a girlfriend, and then I would get that sort of emotional connection with her. And I'd feel like, oh my gosh, I just want to hang with her all the time because I'm getting all of this emotional reinforcement. And I had to consciously shift my emotional attention, at least that initial sharing, from my girlfriends to my husband. And I'd sit on it and I would wait. Honey, you wouldn't believe this interview opportunity that I had, or you wouldn't believe that my book proposal just got accepted. And even if I could not share it with him immediately, I would wait until I could share it with him first. And then he also had to learn to have a euphoric response to that, instead of just going, oh, that's really cool, good job. So what's for dinner tonight? He had to learn that he could condition me to love to share emotional information with him. And in that sense, we got back to the top of that, you know, roller coaster track more often, because we were learning to create rather than just stumble upon emotional intimacy. So should you leave your 8-year marriage? Double L hockey stick, no, you should not, because you're going to be the same person in that next marriage. You're going to recreate the same problems. And especially if you have kids, now your kids are going to be subjected to another adult that is complicating their lives and separating them from their mother at least 50% of the time.
It's interesting, in marriage therapy, I've heard that some of the things that a counselor might do to help people sort of regain that is to walk through, why did you first love this person? Why were you attracted to them at first? What were they doing? What were those things? And it is an interesting exercise, because let's say it was something like you all worked with teenagers and you saw the way your now husband was caring for young men and leading people and working really hard, or, oh, I thought that was so attractive. And, you know, you don't work with teens anymore, and then he works a tech job and he just comes home and he's really tired at the end of the day, and you sit on the couch and watch a show. But reinvigorating the thought of, that's what I saw that was so attractive, it could go a couple ways. First, I'm just remembering what it was that drew me to you in the first place. Second, maybe it's like, you know what? Maybe we need to go work with teenagers in the evening and not give up something that really did kind of bring both of us to life. And we were serving, you know, seeing people serve, pour themselves out to other people. I think this couple doesn't have any kids. You can imagine it might be a double income, no kids situation where you have everything and you're just kind of bored because your life is just for you to hang out. It's not really serving anyone else. So there's can be some techniques there. And I like everything that you said as well. Okay, final question. My husband and I have been married for 9 years. In 2021, we found out he was being sued for child support. So it turned out that he had had an affair shortly after the marriage and has a child. We went to counseling. I agreed to stay in the marriage. Basically, am I a jerk for telling my husband the child from his affair isn't welcome in our home? And if he wants custody, he'll have to move out. The mom, the person he had the affair with, has to go to jail. And so it's either this kid needs to come live with dad and be have full custody, or the kid has to go to the East Coast and live with grandparents or something. And this wife is like, we agreed at the beginning when we decided to keep the marriage, that kid's not going to be a part of our lives. And now she's like, he's going back on his word. And so should I just dump him, or, you know, can I hold my ground, basically?
So, people, this is a lesson in why exclusivity is so important to the marital relationship. Exclusivity is one of the hallmarks, one of the things that sets marriage apart from other relationships that you have. It's not like a relationship you have with somebody on your soccer team. It's not a business partner relationship. It's not a familial relationship like a brother or sister. There is something, because you can have multiple brothers and sisters. You can have a lot of different partners at a law firm. You don't have to stay with the same soccer team forever. There are some things that are true about marriage that need to be true no matter what. And what are those things? What is it that sets this relationship apart from all other relationships that we have? Number one, it is permanent. It is going to last until you die. That's really important, because kids need their mother and father until they die. Like, they don't just need them for a year or 2 years or 12 years or even 22 years. They need them the entire time their parents are alive. Number two, they need this to be complementary. It needs to be a man and a woman, because children need, deserve, and crave and benefit from the parenting of a mother and a father. But the other thing that sets marriage apart from all other relationships is it is exclusive. It is monogamous. You're only married to one. There's no other adults in this relationship. Why is that so important for kids? Because if the relationship is monogamous, if it's exclusive, if it forsakes all others, there will never be a child in a situation that this child is in. And because this relationship was not exclusive as it should have been, now you've got a poor boy paying a terrible price, and secondarily, a woman who was very, very wronged, who probably is also going to have to shoulder the burden for this man's selfish decisions to go outside of the marriage. So this is why we take marriage very, very seriously, because this is not a situation where, oh, all the adults consented and it's no big deal. You've got a kid's life who is being wrecked here. So what is my advice for this wife? That they go to very, very serious counseling and therapy. That he is very honest about how he has harmed both her and the child. And then they work through this with faithful friends, if possible, to work to get the child to be able to be raised by his father and a woman who will understand that even though this is not ideal, not for the child, not for her, not even for the husband, but that this is what is required for adults to do hard things on behalf of children. This is the natural characteristic of sin, is that it affects people that it should not affect. Who is being affected? The wife and the child. But the child should not suffer any more than they already have. And hopefully the wife, with the help of good, faithful friends and counseling, can find a way to make sure the child does not experience any more loss than he already has. Thank you for being with us. Come back next week, and we will do everything that we can to make you champions of children.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.